The following episode first ran in June of last year. We'll be back with a brand new episode next week. What do you get when you mix biology with design and manufacturing? You get materials and products that grow themselves. It's called biofabrication.
We're at the tipping point, kind of like where we were in, say, 1980 with the personal computer. You have the ability to program organisms through DNA and CRISPR control advancing so quickly. And I think we're just going to have an avalanche of grown materials, whether it's leather, packaging, or grown furniture. But then the next step, I think, will be actually biofabricated products that have functions, just like your cell phone has functions as well. And I think that's going to happen, and that's when things are going to get really wild.
Students from universities and design schools all over the world are gathered at the Museum of Modern Art in Manhattan for this year's BioDesign Challenge. Projects include color-changing paint based on a type of beetle, a wristband that glows when the wearer is too intoxicated to drive, and a plastic made from the shells of shrimp.
The Future of Everything, a look ahead from the Wall Street Journal with Jennifer Strong.
Hi, I'm Ali Schockschneider. I'm a teacher at Parsons School of Design in New York.
She teaches classes about biodesign.
So what does the future of design look like with biology?
It's not some distant future concept. A whole host of products are scaling for mass production.
We can already utilize organisms, bacteria, fungi, yeast, all kinds of things to produce novel materials. And I think spider silk is something that you're really starting to see with Adidas and with the North Face. And fungi, I think fungi is really close. These are materials you can touch and feel and smell that can respond to the environment.
I give her a puzzled look when she says you can biofabricate paper. After all, isn't it already made from trees? But then I get it. She's talking about a living bacteria that makes its own cellulose indefinitely from kombucha,
which is a drink that's made with tea and sugar. You add microbes and all of a sudden there's a mat of cellulose floating on the surface.
Biofabrication requires we think differently.
Bacteria basically feed on nutrients, right? And in response, they produce stuff. So they can produce stuff that we've engineered to be a specific pigment, like indigo, to vitamins, even other types of materials like chitin, which is the stuff that mostly makes up insect shells. It's incredibly strong.
Companies use fungi to decompose things. That breaks them down into different new materials.
How we went from just kind of knowing that to using it is really interesting. And I just can imagine 15 to 20 years from now, how blown our minds are going to be by some of the things that are happening.
One of the leaders in working with fungi is in upstate New York, just outside Albany.
My name is Eben Baer, and I'm the CEO and co-founder of Ecovative.
The company says it's growing new kinds of polymers, or plastics, from the roots of mushrooms. It sounds friendlier than saying fungi. If you're wondering, it actually smells great in here, like sawdust.
You could think of this as a giant indoor farm, where we grow a whole range of materials, from packaging to building insulation to beautiful grown objects for your home.
Crate & Barrel and computer maker Dell are among the companies using their version of styrofoam packaging.
We're going to enter what's called the dirty room here, and this is where all the different agricultural raw materials from the field come in. And then they're put into hoppers that are automatically fed into our pasteurization system, which essentially cleans the material and prepares it for inoculation with the mushroom roots or mycelium. We should probably not spend too much time in here because, as you can see, it's dusty and loud and dirty. But that's the sorter. It's fractionating the corn into various sizes. And then based on those sizes, we'll grow composites with different structural properties.
It's a waste product called corn stover, which is the leftover leaves, stalks, and cobs after a harvest.
So we're now on the other side of the wall. So you can see it was really dirty, really dusty in there. Lots of spores and bacteria floating around. Everything on this side of the building is HEPA filtered. With relatively clean air. It's not a clean room, though what we're coming up on here is a clean room.
The chopped up corn is moving through metal tubes that heat, clean, and cool it. Then it gets mixed with mycelium, which is the fungi they use to grow this into products.
These organisms have a metabolism, so you're talking about a watt of heat per wet pound of substrate. And so this is like a human being laying here. It's respirating oxygen, giving off CO2, and you can see it's actually starting to turn white. This will grow for about another 24 hours, then it goes in the fridge, and we put it in stasis.
When you're done making something with this, you have to stop the growing process, or, in other words, you have to kill it, usually by drying it out in an oven.
You can see the parts in there growing, switching from their metabolism to actually being dehydrated to eventually drying out. And they gain structural strength as they do that, almost like curing. This semi-humble box you're looking at here, which is made out of plywood and 2x4s, is actually one of the most important innovations here over the last 10 years.
This 4-foot by 4-foot cube full of hemp and fungi is growing into a giant block of plastic because he's blowing air into the center of it.
What it does is it allows us to grow arbitrarily large blocks of mycelium. So when we grow our packaging parts in our mold facility, we're limited to a couple inches of wall thickness because mycelium doesn't have lungs, right? It has to respirate via diffusion of oxygen into the cells, just like an insect. That's why you don't have really giant insects. We used to have really giant insects, right, when there was more oxygen and like when dinosaurs were around, which is kind of cool. And we also used to have giant fungi, like tree-sized fungi, probably for the same reason.
We climb up the sides and get a closer look.
This white fuzz you see on the surface is pretty fantastic because it's molecular assembly right now. Talk about the promise of nanotechnology. This is nanotechnology. You've got these tiny little cells. They're growing over the surface of the hemp. They're reading what the hemp has. They're going to their DNA, building the right enzyme they need to break down the hemp. That's giving them their food and energy. And as a byproduct, they're actually binding all of this together, which will become the composite we use as an insulating board or a structural board for furniture.
Next, they plan to experiment with commercial composting facilities, which work along the same idea. It's the final step in achieving mass industrial scale. And there's another experiment here that gets both Bayer and designers really excited.
We're currently working on programming colors into the organism, so we'll be able to tell the organism we'd like a bright pink color finish this week, and it'll produce that. Again, I'm really excited about that because you could never tell a plastic you'd like it to be blue. You have to go get blue dye. The other cool thing about that is it's effectively free. Once you're doing all this work with biology and you're growing something, from the organism's perspective to say make a different color, it's metabolically like a rounding error. It's already putting all its effort into growing its body and structure. And that's where you start to get unique economic advantages over conventional synthetics as well.
Not far from us, a woman is making the seat back of a chair.
This is a component that goes into a really high-end chair made by Gundlach Furniture. They've often furnished the White House, and it's a backer that they then upholster. So you've got the same material you saw growing in that reactor, put a hemp mat on top. So again, in conventional composites, you'd add an epoxy or a chemical resin. We just let the mycelium grow through the hemp mat, it turns white, and then when you heat it gently, it further sets the mycelium.
Back in New York City, a company in Brooklyn is growing leather.
Hi, I'm Andras Forgax. I'm the CEO and founder of Modern Meadow.
But they're skipping the cow and going straight for the collagen.
Traditionally, with leather, you get what you get from an animal. Plus, it's a fairly inefficient process in that it takes a lot of steps, a lot of chemical processing, and a lot of miles of transporting materials. By contrast, we start by making the protein that would make those leather materials. And by being able to control the composition of the material, we can control its thickness, its strength, flexibility, its durability. We can also control the aesthetics of the material, what it looks like.
He says what they're not doing here is imitating leather.
This is not about imitation. This is about innovation. By looking at it, you say, wow, this is clearly leather, but it's like no leather I've seen. What animal does that come from? I've never seen anything like it. And that's when we know we've done a good job.
The first step is to make collagen without the animal.
And we do that by engineering cells, by editing their DNA, so that we can grow these cells up to produce collagen. We need to be able to screen through these thousands of variants to be able to pick out our Olympic athletes. And this is like looking for a needle in a haystack. So this is where we run our robots, where they can screen through the thousands and thousands of cells and really pick out the best, the ones that grow the fastest and produce the right quality of collagen at the right levels.
Next, he shows me something that quite literally makes my head spin, a room full of shaking incubators.
Once you've picked out the right kind of cell, you then want to be able to grow it up in larger quantities. And we do that by putting them into incubators. We can shake these cells in flasks where we can maintain the right temperature, the right level of humidity.
And from there, they create their leather.
And that is perhaps our most secret step.
They do go through some steps of tanning, just like you would with traditional leather.
But unlike traditional leather, we can skip many, many parts of the tanning process. For example, we don't need to remove hair, flesh, or fat from the hide.
It also involves a lot less chemistry. Another member of the executive team here is one of the best-known people in the field of biofabrication.
Yes, I'm Suzanne Lee. I'm the Chief Creative Officer of Modern Meadow. I guess that's an unusual title for someone at a biotech company. And indeed, my background is creative rather than science, so I'm a fashion designer by training.
She's the founder of BioFabricate, a yearly summit for makers of grown materials. That's where Adidas unveiled its spider silk shoe. She says for her, it all began with a biologist.
He blew my mind because he said, well, you know, in the future you could grow a dress from a vat of liquid. And that was it for me. You know, I realized that, wow, what does that mean to be a designer when materials can be formed in that way?
Up until now, materials could be classified as either natural or synthetic. Natural materials such as cotton or leather are more beautiful but lack the performance of a synthetic such as lycra. Biofabrication could change that.
So you either had one or the other. You maybe had something that was, you know, comfortable but not very high performing, or very beautiful but again, you know, didn't wear well, or you had something that was very technical but maybe didn't have the aesthetic, wasn't as beautiful to look at, maybe didn't feel as great. What if we had all of the technical capabilities, some of the real performance and functionality that we turn to synthetics for, combined with the comfort, the beautiful aesthetic of a natural material? And that's really what is exciting about biofabrication, is when you bring those two worlds together.
As production ramps up and costs come down, Lee sees a giant shift within the next 5 years in the way we think about these materials.
And I think whether that's furniture that you have in your home or your office, or garments that you wear from biofabricated spider silk or biofabricated leather materials, the seat that goes into your car in 5 years' time could be made from a biofabricated material. So we're going to move into a phase where we start to question the materials that we're touching and ask, is this synthetic, is it natural, or is it biofabricated?
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. We had help with this episode from The Wall Street Journal's Mike Miller, Jennifer Hicks, Larry Root, Tanya Bustos, and Charlie Turner. If you like what you hear, make sure to rate and review us. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong in the newsroom in New York.
Follow The Wall Street Journal on your favorite podcast app. Search WSJ on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, and any Amazon Alexa device. The Wall Street Journal. Listen ambitiously.